Today is Monday, February 1st, 2016. We're meeting here in the Capitol Building in Juneau. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:31 p.m. Committee members present, Vice Chair Senator Costello, Senator Coghill, Senator Stedman, and myself, Senator Giesel, as well as Senator Wadakowski. Welcome. So, our recording secretary today is Anne. Thank you, Anne. And Cody is manning the audio, so thanks very much for helping us out. So today we're going to focus on some other resources, specifically fisheries, mining, and tourism. So we're going to begin today's hearing with a presentation on the subject of salmon genetics. I actually heard part of this presentation at a Pacific States Fisheries Commission meeting last summer. It was very interesting, and I thought it would be a great thing for the Resources Committee to hear. So I welcome Mr. Jeff Guyon from NOAA, the NOAA Fisheries, and Bill Templin from ADF&G. So thanks very much, gentlemen. I know that you just presented in the other body's Resources Committee. Now, they have a long meeting. They have a two-hour meeting. Ours is only 90 minutes. So so you have a 45-minute allowance here. So thanks very much for joining us. I'll let you proceed. And Senator Machicki, for the record, is joining us as well. Welcome, Senator Machicki, and thanks for coming. All right.
Thank you. So my name is Jeff Guyon. I'm a fisheries geneticist with the National Marine Fisheries Service, part of the Alaska Fisheries Science Center. And to my right is Bill Templin, and Bill's the principal fisheries geneticist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And Bill's allowed me to talk first, if it's okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So the talk that I'm going to give is centered around salmon. But first, I want to thank the Senate Resources Committee for enabling me to come here and to talk about some of the things that we're doing. It's really an honor to be here today. So some of the work, although we're going to talk about salmon most of the time, we also work on other fish species, including herring. We're both here in Lynn Canal and out at Prince William Sound. We use genetics to distinguish closely related rockfish species. And we worked with scientists down in Seattle to, as a collaboration, discover a new species of sand lance last year. It was from Japan, but it was really cool. So what we do in our lab is we take biological data, our biological samples from a fish, and we digitize it by using a technique called genotyping. So each one of these dots is an individual fish. And the purpose is to understand from where fish are caught, to understand what their potential impacts are. So that's what we do. So we're going to go through some NOAA technical memorandums. So this is the data for chum salmon. It's going to be about the chum salmon bycatch from the 2013 Bering Sea Walleye Pollock Trawl Fishery. And at the very top is a link that you can see that has a link to the NOAA tech memo if you need any of the data. And if there's anything that I don't explain well, or if you're in town, I'm just out at the Auk Bay Labs, which is just out the road. And both me and there's Chuck Guthrie in the back. So Chuck is one of the scientists that I'll introduce later. So this work from Chum Salmon is led by Chris Conzilla and with Jackie and Scott.
Excuse me, Mr. Guyon. Senator Wilkowski had a question.
Can I just ask statistically, is this the actual number, or is this an extrapolation based on certain ships bycatch?
So I'll try to be careful through the chair, if it's okay. I'll try to be careful through what's an extrapolation and where the numbers come from. So there will be, at the end, with the Gulf of Alaska Chinook salmon bycatch, there will be an extrapolation there. With the other samples, there will be direct numbers.
I just also want to inject that Senator Stoltz has joined us. Welcome. And former Representative Bill Thomas is in the audience. Welcome.
So to frame the fishery about the chum salmon bycatch is in the Bering Sea. There's a pollock trawl fishery that everybody's aware of. It's a very large fishery. They catch over 1 million tons of pollock. It's quite clean, but since it's so large, they also incidentally catch a number of other fish species, including chum salmon. And so we're going to determine where those chum salmon are from. So this is the magnitude of the chum salmon bycatch by different years from 1994 to 2013. It peaked in 2007, and the sample set we're going to talk about is in 2013, when there was an estimated 125,000. And for that, there was an actual, it was a count as it goes through. So it ends up being about 126,000. So people have been interested to know what stocks of salmon are caught in the Bering Sea. So they've looked at it different ways, both using scales and allozymes previously. So the scale work was done at the University of Washington. The allozyme work was done, which is a type of genetic marker, was done at our lab in collaboration with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Most recently, we've used another genetic marker called microsatellites to determine where those fish are from.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Stoltz.
I was still just, thank you. I'm just a little flummoxed. I heard the statement, the pollock fishery is pretty clean, but there's just a little incidental catch. I just have never heard that characterized as such a de minimis impact, and that certainly wasn't how it was characterized by the governor while he was campaigning for office. Bycatch was a very large issue, and now it seems like it's kind of an afterthought. I want to make sure I don't mischaracterize what I heard, but I had a... It took me a couple seconds to reflect, and I just wonder if they want to backtrack on that statement and just maybe elaborate a little bit.
Through the chair, I'm sorry if I misspoke, but the pollock fishery is such a large fishery that the fish that it intercepts that are incidentally caught, both chum salmon and Chinook salmon, the numbers can be quite large. And as you can see in 2005, the catch in 2005 was over 700,000 chum salmon. And so I'll show you with the Chinook data, in some years that's exceeded 100,000.
Thank you.
So for chum salmon, the baseline, what we're going to do is take the salmon samples that we have and partition them back to where they're from using a genetic baseline. So each of these dots that you see on this graph, so this chum salmon that are in the Bering Sea can be intercepted from anywhere throughout their species range. So each of those dots represents a collection of populations. And we took those collections, this is from a Canadian baseline, and we aggregated them into six different regional aggregations. So the stock compositions that you're going to see partition the fish back to these groupings. I'd like to highlight the Western Alaska grouping that you see here. So this Western Alaskan grouping, I'm going to talk at the very end. Chum salmon aren't well distinguished there, but we'll talk about that at the very end. So in 2013, the pollock fishery occurs throughout the year. There's two different seasons. There's an A season and a B season. And at the bottom on the x-axis, you have the from week 0 through 50, so from January through December. So the pollock fishery is occurring in the A season, but shown in blue, the blue line that you see, they're not encountering many chum salmon, incidentally, in the A season. In the B season, they do incidentally harvest chum salmon as you go through. And the scale of the number of fish that are collected is on the left-hand side. And these are counts. This is actually a census that's done in the Bering Sea. The genetic samples that you see off to the side are this dashed line, and the scales off to the right-hand side. And what I'd like to highlight here is the amount of effort and work that's gone into collecting this particular sample set. It's been a lot of work from a lot of people, including the observers, the industry, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and others, to get us to this point. The sample set's just very impressive. I'd like to highlight that in the next slide. So in this slide, each one of these dots represents an individual vessel that participated in the B season fishery in 2013. These vessels, like this particular dot, this vessel intercepted somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,200 chum salmon. This is the number of genetic samples that was collected. So this is the genetic sampling protocols that have been implemented as part of different amendments that have been made to the fishery management plans in the Bering Sea. And so, as a scientist, it's always amazing when you see such a beautiful line as it goes through, and the massive amount of effort that's been done by all the different observers, and often working under very harsh conditions, to enable the shipment of samples that often go through Dutch Harbor, or Anchorage, or Sandpoint, or Seattle, all to one lab for analysis. So for the stock composition analysis that we had was in 2013, which is shown in red. And how you interpret this, it's compared to other previous years that we have. And you have to be a little cautious because samples were collected differently in different years. But how you read this is about 15% of the fish were caught from Southeast Asia in 2015. And 45% of the sample came from Northeast Asia, which is basically Russia. So what this shows is about 60% of the chum salmon that were encountered in 2013 were derived from Asian stocks. 40% were derived from North American stocks. And so as geneticists, we produce proportions. What's the percentage of the sample set that came from a certain area? To understand what the impacts are, and this gets to the senator's comment as it goes through, you can take the proportions that we have and extrapolate them based on the size of the bycatch. So in 2013, the size of the bycatch was 126,000 fish, and you can multiply the numbers proportions to get estimates. For example, there were about 24,000 fish from western Alaska that were estimated to have been intercepted in 2013.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stoltz.
Thank you. What does the department do with that information? So we have policies where we promote the coastal community's involvement in CDQs and these larger operations, and then those same coastal communities, maybe not the same participants, we spend research money and attention on the deficiencies of chum salmon and king salmon that are getting to the western Alaska rivers. How does the collecting of this manifest, and what decisions you're making, and you're advising the legislature on what's good for the western Alaska communities? How do you weigh opportunity A and opportunity B, and help advise us? You're taking one opportunity for the other, and how do you put the science into helping the political decisions be made?
Through the chair, that's an excellent question, and something that we work through our council process. So the data that we produce here is worked closely with the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and has been led into amendments that have happened to amendments 91, 93, 97 that have gone into the different fishery management plans. So the data that we provide goes into stock scientists, for example. Jimmy and Ellie did an adult equivalent model, and they're trying to figure out how many of the adult fish would have been impacted in western Alaska for Chinook salmon. So the data that we provide here goes into modeling efforts like that.
Madam Chair.
Yes, follow up.
You mentioned it, advising through our participation through the Pacific Council and other international groups. How does that information get to the decisions made here in state regarding our fisheries? Whether or not do you get involved? There's a bill in that will enhance the ease of loans for large vessels ground fisheries, but we do that. At the same time, we were investing large amounts in trying to repropagate and research our chum and king salmon. How do you advise our, if it works right, our Commissioner of Fish and Game helps direct the our representation on those councils to work in Alaska interest, but that's if it works right. Are you able to exert your pressure? Do you have enough freedom to say, hey, that's a stupid decision we're making. We're robbing Peter to pay Paul over here, and Paul likes it, and Peter's outraged.
Through the chair, what I do is that the data that we produce, as I mentioned, goes through the council process, and the data to get to the state works very closely with Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So I'll highlight some of the connections and the synergies we have with the state and how we share data with them along the way to help through state processes.
Thank you.
Senator Michiki.
This is sort of more about quantity of bycatch. So if the mean on this slide, the mean looks like it's around
165,000, is that correct?
That's correct.
Through the chair, that's correct. How do you explain 2012? How do we encourage more of that at 24,000?
Through the chair, again, another excellent question. And I'd like to highlight the difference between the median and the mean. And so the median might have been a better statistic because it was driven in large part by this number of 700,000 in 2005. Mm-hmm. But you can see the stability of the bycatch that occurred over a number of years in this particular process that did drive a lot of management concerns. So when it got up to 700,000 fish, there were a lot of concerns. And so as a geneticist, what I try to do is try to level out so that we're producing a stock composition across the different years, and that we're not just reacting all the time to a particular thing that happened, but that we have a genetics program in place that can analyze the bycatch throughout the entire process.
Just another quick one, Madam Chair.
Senator Michiki.
If we were to see the sort of distribution, I suppose, on that same chart for Coho and Chinook, would it look similar? Were those heavy years for bycatch, or were they heavy years for a specific species for bycatch?
Through the chair, the heavy year for chum salmon was in 2005, and the heavy year for Chinook salmon is going to be in 2007, and I'm going to show that chart that you're going to see.
Okay.
So these are the stock proportions, and again, we went through and extrapolated to figure out numbers of fish. And these slides are just put in place to show that, in addition to determine just numbers of fish, we are doing stock compositions based on time and area strata within the Bering Sea, so we can better understand where particular stocks of fish are that might help potential management actions. And how stable is that? And it gets difficult because we're doing stock composition on fish we're trying not to catch. It's a little bit different. This is just a highlight that we have a project with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the University of Alaska, and the Western Alaska Salmon Coalition to try to further differentiate chum salmon in Western Alaska, which are quite homogeneous and difficult to separate. But it would be good to understand impacts to the Yukon, Kuskokwim, and other rivers in Western Alaska. We move from chum salmon to Chinook salmon.
Excuse me, Mr. Guyon. Senator Walikowski.
Can you put this in some sort of perspective for me? When you talk about the number of salmon, it's 125,000. In peak years, it was 500,000, 600,000. I guess two questions. Number one, genetically, are you're actually able to trace the genetics to particular streams? That's question one. And question two is, in terms of, I guess, global bycatch for chum salmon, do you have any sort of sense of how much of the chum salmon are being caught in bycatch on a yearly basis? So just chums, kings, I mean, is it 1%, is it 10%?
Through the chair, we'll answer the first question, it's an easier question as it goes through. We don't take an individual fish and allocate it to an individual stream, just based on accuracies associated. It becomes more accurate the larger the aggregations that we have, the more genetically similar things are. And so we've partitioned them to these six large groupings as it goes through rather than an individual stream. And with regard to the total number of chum salmon throughout the world.
Chums, kings, I mean, just a general sense. How big of a problem is this worldwide?
So for chum salmon, I think there's, maybe Bill can correct me. It's hard when I'm speaking off the top of my cuff on this one. So we work with the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission, and we go through, and one of the statistics are hatchery releases that are associated with chum salmon. And they're in, if I remember right, in the billions. And so I don't know what the returns are, and I don't have enough information to fully answer your question. What they have done is both in the council process for both Chinook and for chum, which are the two salmon species that are intercepted, they've done analyses, both economic and biological analyses, to understand what are the impacts to Western Alaska. And for those, I could get the council links to those particular sites. I participate in providing data to those. I didn't do those particular analyses. But I can get you that data if it would be helpful. And so for Chinook salmon, this is the data that you can have here is the actual second time it's been presented. The first time was just a few minutes ago at the House Resources Committee. So this is the Chinook salmon bycatch data from the 2014 Bering Sea walleye pollock trawl fishery. There's a link at the top, so you can download the report if you need any of the additional information. This report was led by Chuck Guthrie and Han Van Gwen. And just to highlight what the issue is there's the pollock fishery in the Bering Sea that intercepts not just chum salmon, but also Chinook salmon. And we're going to determine where those Chinook salmon are from. So this is the magnitude of the Chinook salmon bycatch for the different years from 1992 to 2014, shown in the purple line that you see at the top. And this is the A season and the B season. So the A season is the spring season for catching pollock, and the B season is the fall season. So if you add the A season and the B season, you should get the total down. These are statistics that are provided through the Alaska Regional Office, the National Marine Fisheries Service Regional Office, that's here in Juneau. So again, we've wanted to understand what are the stocks that are impacted, and work's been done, again, using scale pattern analysis and both genetic analysis by the University of Washington, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and the National Marine Fisheries Service. And again, these stock compositions are generally in very good agreement between all these different techniques and all these different organizations. It's worked out quite well. The baseline that we're using for Chinook salmon is a SNP baseline, which is a type of genetic marker. And Bill, in his talk, will show more information about this. But each one of these dots represents an individual population that have been genotyped and then aggregated based on their genetic similarity. So we've aggregated them into 11 different stock groupings. So when we come back, I'm going to give you information to these groups. So like with chum salmon, what you can see in the x-axis is the different weeks of the fishery. So this is at the beginning of the season and the end of the season. This is the A season, that's the B season. So shown in blue is the magnitude of the bycatch in 2014 throughout the season, and shown in the dotted line are all the genetic samples that have been collected. And again, I don't want to underestimate the amount of effort that's gone into making sure that we can collect samples like this to better understand what are the potential impacts. It's just a massive amount of work from a large number of people. So this is the data that we have for 7 years. Again, you have to be careful because how samples are collected is different in 1 year to the next year. But shown in light blue is the stock composition that we got from 2014. And you read this graph by showing that about 50% of the samples that we have were derived from coastal western Alaska in 2014. What you take from this graph is that these particular groupings represent river systems that flow into the Bering Sea. So the largest proportion of fish that are being caught in the Bering Sea are from river systems that flow into the Bering Sea. There are stocks from throughout the species range, though, that are intercepted in this particular fishery. This is going to be different than what you're going to see in the Gulf. So if we move quickly to the Gulf, again, it's just out. It just came out a few weeks ago. There's a link at the top. So this is the genetic analysis of the Chinook salmon bycatch from the 2014 Gulf of Alaska trawl fisheries that we have, again led by Chuck and Han Vaughn. These are the issues. So there's a pollock fishery. It's a smaller pollock fishery, but a pollock fishery that's quite big, still in the Gulf of Alaska, and also a rockfish and arrowtooth flounder trawl fisheries that also intercept Chinook salmon as bycatch, and we're going to determine where they're from. Like the other graphs, you can see at the top the magnitude of the Gulf of Alaska Chinook salmon bycatch throughout the different years. Shown in red is the pollock, the number of bycatch that came from the pollock fishery, and the other is the other, like the rockfish and the arrowtooth flounder fisheries.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Stoltz.
Thanks. I'm sorry to keep up. I'm trying to get a grasp on this. I'm trying to I understand you've identified the genetics and the source of these fish, but is there an acceptable amount of bycatch that's sustainable? I think Senator Machicki's from Florida. They have an acceptable amount of fly parts for concentrated orange juice that doesn't harm you, I guess. But what we're looking at what the resource can sustain. And one thing I've never really got a grasp on is what is an allowable amount of bycatch. I mean, some folks will say none. You don't want to kill a single. We probably don't have the technology. It'd probably be so expensive to catch. Where do we get to what the real answer is? And I know we don't have decision-making ability on these, but if our membership on the council, the governor through his prudent appointments, and the commissioner exercising an Alaskan fishery, we do have a majority on there if the processors haven't snuck on too many people, and not to be pejorative, but that's what happens. And what is the amount, and how we manifest that Alaskan interest? And I know you, I'm sorry, I didn't, until I looked through my notes, I didn't realize you were from the federal government, but I know you're here to help us.
Through the chair, that's a big weight. And so as a geneticist, we provide information through our rulemaking activity, which goes through a council process along the way. So, which goes through and identifies using different modeling, both economic and biological, to understand potential impacts that sets and helps with rulemaking activity. And so, I would refer you to the links that I can provide you that have been analyses that have been done through the council. I'm not an expert in. And some of the other things.
It's probably not a simple question or a simple answer. I'm grasping, though. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. Senator Coghill.
While we're asking questions, thank you for presenting to us. So we have the chum and the Chinook. When they get to the Yukon River, for example, quite often they run together. So is there an overlay that we're going to see, or is there something you can tell us about the bycatch of those two species simultaneously?
Through the chair, that's an excellent point and something that I didn't anticipate, but when I get to one of the next graphs, maybe I can go back real quick and show one of the differences between them.
Thank you.
Maybe it's okay to go back now. So just go real quick to show. So this is the... In 2014, I had shown this chart which showed the the Bering Sea, the Chinook salmon that were intercepted as bycatch, that's shown in the blue line. And this is the A season of the pollock fishery. This is the B season of the pollock fishery. So, again, they're catching pollock in both seasons, and they're intercepting Chinook salmon, in this case, in the A and B season. If you go back to Chum, the same fishery, you know, this is 2013, but basically the same fishery with the same type of data. They're not intercepting Chum salmon in the A season, but are intercepting them in the B season. So the A season bycatch with regards to salmon is predominantly a Chinook salmon issue, and the B season is both.
And the point is that on the lower Yukon, when it was time to catch fish, the kings were forbidden while the Chinook went by. And the big runs of Chinook, the best they could do is dip net them. And they had to catch and release kings. And it was exceedingly difficult. So I was just, so for me, for them to run so differently in the bycatch time means something's happening at the near coast, that's all.
So, with the back in the Gulf of Alaska, with the pollock fishery, so this is the estimate of the number of salmon that are taken in the bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska, again, broken down by the pollock fishery and the other fisheries that we have. These are the trawl fisheries. And again, there's been efforts that have been done in the past to understand what potential stocks are impacted. And so this is work that was done with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and the University of Washington, and this is work that was done with the National Marine Fisheries Service. And again, the data that we're getting from both different types of analysis are suggested are very similar, which is good. So in the Gulf of Alaska, and this gets to one of the questions that we had earlier about extrapolations and things like this. So the Gulf of Alaska is done a little bit differently, the way we collect samples and how bycatch is estimated. So what you see in this graph is, again, from the beginning of the season to the end of the season in the Gulf of Alaska, this is the estimated bycatch that occurred, Chinook salmon bycatch, in the spring season and the fall season. And these are the genetic samples that we have, what you see in this dotted line. And the dotted line roughly approximates the bycatch that we have, but it's not as pretty as what you saw before. And the reason for this is the way samples are collected, our observers are deployed in our Gulf of Alaska fisheries is different than how they are in the Bering Sea, where the vessels are larger and there's more room to put them. So in the Gulf of Alaska, it's smaller. The vessels are smaller. It's more difficult to put people on there. And so for that reason, samples, genetic samples, are taken from a systematic random sampling with respect to crews. So they randomly select a cruise, and then they collect all the genetic samples from that particular cruise that they're on. It produces a result that looks like this. And to get samples that produce an estimate for the entire catch, what we do is we produce a weighted estimate. We take the samples we have and we weight them by time and space to produce an overall estimate. So that's what's done.
Mr. Grant, Senator Machiki had a question.
Just, you know, and you don't need to go back, but when you talked about the difference between the A and B season, particularly with Chum salmon, it could one assume that the reason that other three species of Pacific salmon are not a bycatch problem just because they're not there while the pollock fisheries are occurring, or is there some other reason?
Through the chair, it's not my direct level of expertise, but it may have something to do with, of how the fish are intercepted. So are the fish, the salmon, interacting with the pollock? Are they caught there? Are they above the pollock and being intercepted by the net as the net's going down or coming up as it goes through? So there may be differences in life strategies between the different fish of where they're being intercepted, especially at the distance they are from the shore. So to get to that point, in the Gulf of Alaska, it's generally a Chinook salmon bycatch issue. So they don't intercept in general very many Chum salmon, although this past report that you're going to see in about 2 weeks contains a sample set of Chum salmon from the Gulf of Alaska. But it's unusual to, it's generally Chinook salmon in the Gulf of Alaska. And so with our, using these weighted techniques, which are again developed in conjunction, coordination with Bill Templin's group at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, so a lot of help and it's appreciated. These are the stock compositions we get in the Gulf of Alaska for the various years. And again, you have to be careful because it's different how samples are collected. But what you do see is that you don't pick up fish from the Bering Sea. So what you saw in the Bering Sea fishery, it was the number of stocks that were here. And it's changed to both the west coast of the United States, British Columbia, coastal southeast Alaska, and river systems that flow into the Gulf of Alaska. So the salmon that are encountered are different in both fisheries. In the last two slides, I just want to go through. So these, in addition to a pollock fishery, there's also other trawl fisheries that occur in the Gulf, including a rockfish trawl fishery. So this is a part of the rockfish trawl fishery, an area that was just off Kodiak. There's other parts of it. But in this fishery, industry collected samples. They weren't required to collect samples. They didn't have to collect them. They're not required by law. What they did do is did a census of all the samples that came into their processing plants. They collected genetic samples and sent them to us for analysis. Based on these census, and this, we analyzed the samples along the way, and we produced a stock composition, which again is suggestive of fish from the west coast of the United States, British Columbia, and the Gulf of Alaska flowing stocks that you can see here. And this is a map that you can see basically where the rockfish fishery is occurring, and the timeline, which is a little bit different from, this is in between the spring and the fall season in the Gulf. Likewise, there's also an Arrowtooth flounder trawl fishery. Again, industry's not required to do this, but at their own expense, they went and collected samples. This wasn't a census. They didn't collect them from every salmon they got, but just from an opportunistic. But in 2014, it was the majority of samples. The majority of fish were sampled and sent to us. And again, you can see the same type of result, and there's a map that shows basically where the fisheries occur. And the last slide is just an acknowledgement, which I sincerely appreciate all the work Chris Conzeal. She led our chum salmon work, Chuck Guthrie, Sharon, Han Von, Jackie, and Scott. The North Pacific Groundfish and Halibut Observer Program, which has done an amazing job. They went through a reorganization along the way to address some of these issues. The sample sets we have now are amazing. I also kind of caution people not to expect as much all the time. We can't always get samples like we did in that one line there. But just an amazing amount of work from a large number of people and hundreds of observers that are working in very difficult conditions to get to this, so I can be here and present the data to you. So I'm really appreciative of that. With Fish and Game, there's Bill and Andrew and Jim who have shared not only their baseline and their expertise, but also some of the statistical support and some of the analysis prior analysis. And these are the two groups that provided the rockfish samples and the Arrowtooth flounder samples. And just for the funding, it's important to know where the funding is that's coming to analyze this. For just the genetic part, it's funded by the National Marine Fisheries Service. The Alaska Sustainable Salmon Fund funded some of our work. And with that, it required a non-federal match, and that was provided by the North Pacific Fisheries Research Foundation, which is an industry group that provided some of that money. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Guyon. Very good. So now, Mr. Templin.
So, Madam Chair, am I correct in saying that about 10 minutes for my presentation?
No, let's do 15.
Okay. Still be a wild ride. All right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present what we do here. Unfortunately, it's a lot of ground to cover in the amount of time that we have. It won't be exactly the same talk, so I hope you'll forgive me if I don't hit everything that that you heard in Girdwood. But
and would you introduce yourself for the record, too, Mr. Templin?
My name is Bill Templin. I'm the principal geneticist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I run the Gene Conservation Laboratory of the Commercial Fisheries Division in Anchorage. And I, too, extend a welcome to anybody who's in town and would like to see the operation or talk with us about any of the things that you hear here. So. One of the main questions that we often receive is, why does Alaska Department of Fish and Game have a genetics lab? Why is there a need for a genetics lab in a fish and a wildlife resource agency? And it's mainly because our job is to help the department achieve its mission. The mission of the Department of Fish and Game is to protect, maintain, improve the fish and game and aquatic plant resources of the state, and manage their use. So there are four things in there: protect, maintain, improve, and manage. We do this so that we can develop in the best interest of the economy and the well-being of the people of the state. So in a lot of many situations, we are data limited, have to make conservative decisions, have to figure out how to balance things like protecting and maintaining with improving and managing. So that's why we have a genetics lab. We can use the genetics technology to address information needs, as well as to make decisions on things like hatchery permitting and human uses. So our services generally fall into four categories: understanding the resource, giving a basic understanding of what the resource looks like. Second, to develop the capabilities for management, new tools, new methods that utilize the rapidly increasing technology available through genetics. We also use the information that we gain to help assess genetic risk, which is one of our main responsibilities in a permitting setting. And fourth, we also use this information to inform and assess management actions. So after the fact, or even in season, we can use information provided through genetics to actually manage the resource. So some of the questions that we receive are: did exposure to oil cause genetic injury? This was after the oil spill in Prince William Sound. What species of salmon is this? We often receive samples from putative Atlantic salmon captured in Alaska waters. Is this crab a hybrid? There are fisheries, crab fisheries, where there are different management objectives for two different species and their hybrids. So how do we know what if a crab is a hybrid? Which broodstock are these hatchery salmon from? What is the genetic structure of these populations? This is an issue we're dealing with right now, developing new information on coho salmon in Cook Inlet. And where are these fish going? Chinook salmon in the Yukon River is a good example. As fish pass the pilot station test fishery, we get samples, we run them in season, and we can get an estimate of the Canadian component of that and get a sense of what's going to be needed to meet treaty needs. And finally, and more local here, is whose fish are being harvested. This goes throughout the state, but an example would be the Chinook salmon harvested here in Southeast Alaska under the Pacific Salmon Treaty. So that information is used directly in the treaty arena. I'm going to give you four examples. I will probably be rolling along here real quick. I'm sorry you can't see the map, but it's kind of there, kind of not. But red king crab are an important resource for the state of Alaska. Red king crab occur throughout the North Pacific and Bering Sea, generally within that red band that has to do with depth. But you can see that a good portion of the range is here in Alaska and extends over to Southeast Alaska. In order to provide information for management of this resource, we took samples from populations across the state of Alaska, from Southeast Alaska over into Bristol Bay, near the Pribilofs and up in Norton Sound, and actually just off the screen at the bottom in the Aleutians. And we got one sample also from the far west side of the range, from the Okhotsk Sea.
Wanted to welcome Senate Rules Chair Senator Huggins joining us. Welcome.
So, real short, here is a way of looking at genetic relationships. Think of this big box as kind of a map, but not a map of geography, but a map of genetic space. The closer any two points are, each dot is a population, the closer they are, the more similar they are, the further apart they are, the more distinct they are genetically. And if you look at the map inset there, you can see that the red dots on the far right are all from Southeast Alaska. They're very geographically very close together, but genetically there's some distance among them. If you look on towards the middle at the bottom, you see the blue dots, which one of those dots comes from the Aleutians, one from Norton Sound, and one from Russia. And you can see genetically how similar they are, even though geographically they're over a wide range. One thing I do want to point out is that there is a red dot in the upper left-hand corner, which is from Seymour Canal. So The largest distinctions among red king crab populations in this data set come from the smallest area of collection within Southeast Alaska. Also, if you look across the range of the species, you can see each of these dots indicates a population and its measure of genetic diversity. So basically what you're looking at is the trend as you move from west to east, you're looking at a decrease in genetic diversity within populations. So now why are we doing this? What's the use for this? Well, the implications of the study are, one, there's the understanding of the historical contingencies that led to this population structure, which also helps us understand what might happen in the future, especially in changing climates, changing landscapes, and human activities. Second, it lets us know that red king crab might in some areas be managed in a much smaller geographic area, and some areas may be in a much larger geographic area, so we can use that to help understand and shape management. And third, it provides information on human activities. There's currently a program ongoing looking at hatchery supplementation of red king crab stocks. And so we can use this information to help us guide our decisions in a permitting setting. Next is the another example is developing capabilities. All right, without that baseline that Dr. Guyon spoke about for Chinook salmon across its range in the North Pacific, none of that work that he showed would be possible. Likewise, none of the smaller amounts of work in Cook Inlet or Copper River, Southeast Alaska or Western Alaska or on the Yukon would be possible. So there was the effort to put together this large coastwide baseline developed capabilities for the state and for many other agencies and including international groups. So in order to do this, we had to work with international friends, colleagues, through the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission to get samples from throughout the range. Also, we work with colleagues in the Pacific Salmon Commission arena up and down the West Coast and in BC, which will give us access to information and samples from the eastern side of the species range. Of course, you've seen this map. These are all the populations put together, 172 populations. They're colored by regional grouping. But if we throw this all together into what we call a tree, each dot is, again, corresponds to a place on the map. The distance or the difference between populations is measured by the distance you have to go down a branch and then up another branch to get to two populations. So you can, by just squinting your eyes and looking at this and then looking at the map, you can see that populations from some areas group together. And other areas, populations are disparate or far apart. A couple of things I want to point out real quick here. If you look at the Western Alaska, Norton Sound, down to Bristol Bay, those square yellow boxes, if you look at the map, at the tree, are all together clustered right tight here. So genetically, very similar to each other, geographically, again, very disparate, and we've been working at breaking those apart. If you look at, say, the Yukon River, way up in the Yukon territories, the red boxes there, that's the upper Yukon, then we move down the river to the green boxes and then out to the Bering Sea. If you look at the tree, you'll see that similar pattern occurring here, the reddish boxes, and then the green boxes are together and the yellow boxes. That's the kind of information that we use for applications on the Yukon River. It helps us meet treaty needs on the Yukon River. It also helps us achieve some basic information or integrate with federal studies in marine studies where they're actually capturing juvenile salmon. And we use that information to get a sense of where juvenile salmon leaving these rivers are going and combining that together with ecological studies to get a sense of how what the survivals might be like, what might be the production in the next 4 or 5 years.
Question?
Senator Michiki.
So it's kind of interesting because if you look at like the river system distribution in northwestern Western Alaska, yet the yellow boxes seem to congregate. But southeast, sort of similar coastal difference or distance, but they seem to be all over the place. Why? What do you attribute that to?
There are a couple of theories out there. One of them has to do with glaciers, and much of this area was covered with glaciers, and there could be no salmon there. So then the recolonization of rivers in these areas over time, whether they came from the south, whether they came from the west, the amount of time the area has been open, so the age of the population itself, there's certainly a lot more geographic variability and a lot more effect of the glaciers in some of these areas than in others. So I would say that in southeast Alaska, we're seeing the effect of colonization, recently receding glaciers, and the expansion from populations down south, which were probably much larger and a larger reserve of genetic diversity during the maximum of the last glacial maximum than the group out to the west in the Bering Sea and Russia area. And so you can see a real pattern there. Look at all those orange dots and how on the right side of the tree and how distinct those are. Those are up from the west coast, Columbia River, Puget Sound, Washington coast, and then on up into British Columbia. So here's real quick, we're also using this information, again, in combination not just with federal studies, but with, again, colleagues, Russians and Japanese high seas programs through the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission. And what all these circles and stock compositions really boil down to are these maps on the right, which give us a sense of Chinook salmon movements during time, across seasons in the Gulf of Alaska and Bering Sea. All right, so my next information need that we address is in managing hatcheries. Now I'm going to have to fly through this pretty fast, so just ride with me. I've made it into a cartoon to try to get the idea across. At the circles at the top of this plot indicate genetic distinctiveness of the different populations. So we got five populations. And then through time, if you follow the arrows down, you see the populations maintain somewhat this level of color difference. Even when there's in the presence of some basic straying population to population, over time it comes to an equilibrium, and this is what we see. This is what we measure. We take a sample now from one of these populations and we put it in a hatchery and we reproduce it like a copy machine. We just make a lot of them, right? And we release them for harvest. It's what we do. It provides economic activity. Over time, though, if these fish are going back into the hatchery, constantly going back in the hatchery, not going it and being respawned in the wild, there's a different selection pressure in the hatchery and they become domesticated over time. Okay, that's the expectation. This is like worst case scenario. But this is the expectation. This is the basis we have to use, the theory we use to make decisions on permitting hatchery activities, et cetera. So in the presence of a hatchery, we start with the same type of populations. We get the strain from the hatchery into these populations, and over time they become more and more like the hatchery. Okay? Again, worst case scenario, but if we're being conservative, that's kind of what we have to be thinking about. But it'd be so much better if we actually had some information. So we went to the Prince William Sound. Each dot is a chum salmon stream in Prince William Sound, one of the major chum salmon streams in the area. We took streams where we had samples from back before the hatchery. We could take DNA out off of scales from scale cards, right? So we have samples of the DNA for the population prior to the hatchery, and we can get samples today. So now we can look for a change in that population across time and see whether the hatchery has had an effect. So if we go back to this plot, you can see we've got contemporary samples and historical samples, and we've got samples from the hatchery, so we're going to use that to measure.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is wild a scientific term? I know it's used widely as a marketing term, and it almost seems like a hatchery fish that goes out for several years, maybe. It may not be wild, but it's almost feral, if nothing else. And it's what's the differentiation between a hatchery fish that's out there on its own versus wild versus scientific definition versus marketing definition?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, that is a question that a lot of people are asking themselves. Generally what we use is in a situation where the fish have come from the natural system but may have had hatchery influence, we use the term natural. And in a place, in a situation, now these are not hard and fast terms, but, and in a place where there has been probably no hatchery influence, we might call them wild. So.
Follow-ups?
Yeah, Madam Chair, so is it, it becomes a pretty, I'm in my 10th year volunteering on ASME as an ex officio, and it's a, I try to differentiate with the, there it's more marketing, and so is, if it's hatchery, I don't want it to have a, when we in a display like this, don't want to put a pejorative on something that we've helped propagate. It's almost not calling a baby that's born with a little bit of scientific assistance not a real baby.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, that's a good point. And what I'd like to do is point out that the effects that we've measured from this program show that the natural production, the populations in streams, have not changed appreciably from in the presence of the hatchery in Prince William Sound. So whether you call them wild or whether you call them natural is a decision that hasn't been made yet. Under the hatchery wild program, have been calling them wild. It's the program funded by the state. It's a large-scale study of hatcheries, the pink salmon and chum salmon in Prince William Sound and chum salmon in southeast Alaska. And so,
and Madam Chair, I guess we'll have to check and make sure wild hasn't been trademarked by somebody, and we wouldn't want our fishing game to be askew with the law and sued by one of our operators. I'm not trying to be flip, but I was just... You just never know. We've had a whole issue with Alaska Grown and not a good protection of our copyrights. And I hope you can't copyright wild.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, I can't make a decision.
I know you're not the patent attorney or the trademark.
Question?
Yes, Senator Michicki.
So back a slide. Trying to understand why there's a strain. If you use strict controls of wild native brood stock, I mean, you've got eggs and milk from the same river system, you're selecting carefully. Why is there strain?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki. I can think of several answers for that. One, the first is that straying is a fundamental life history strategy for salmon. They return generally to their place where they respond. That provides an advantage to those fish that return because it was at least good enough when they were born to provide for their children, right? There's a hope for that. But the straying is potentially a fundamental opportunistic life history trait where you maybe take the bet that maybe you'll find a place where you don't have to compete so hard or maybe a place that's a little bit better. So that's one of the theories, one of the ideas behind why salmon stray. There is no controlling fish returning to these streams. There's no weirs or gates on them, and if there were, there aren't name tags on these fish to know where they originated from. So we rely a lot upon the biology of the species to, in general, return to its where it was born. And then we have through the genetics policy, we cite some hatcheries. We cite away from other salmon streams of similar species. That happens here in southeast Alaska, where we generally cite Chinook salmon hatcheries away from the sensitive areas where natural production occurs. In places like Prince William Sound or in Cook Inlet, we actually do a more of an integrated system where we cite them right next to the stream or that the original stock actually came from, so to reduce the effect of straying.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Michicki.
I'll ask that in another way. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the incidence of an imprinted outgoing smolt from a river system is straying higher with hatchery fish than with the natural population. That's sort of what I was getting at, because your diagram seems to suggest that, but...
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, yes, we don't... Unfortunately, that's one of the places where we don't have information, is what is the natural stray rate. We can measure the stray rate from a hatchery, because all hatchery fish in Prince William Sound are marked with an otolith mark. Little bands are put on the otolith, the ear bone. And so we can go into a stream and take heads from a set number of carcasses and look to see what proportion of those actually have the mark from the hatchery. That's one way we can tell. But to go from stream to stream is a very difficult thing. It would be hard to control, and it would be expensive to do. So we don't really have a measure of that. My diagram here was mainly a cartoon to try to get across some of the major ideas, and I did take out, to make it cleaner, all the individual little hatchery, I mean, what population to population straying events. So.
Okay, thanks.
Chair, just really briefly.
Yeah, brief, Senator okay. Stiltz, we are running up on a time.
On the genetics issue, on our state fisheries, is there any area of the state where there's a lot of use that we're really lacking in genetic information more than any another area? If you were to pick a weak spot on state management.
Through the chair, Senator Stiltz. That was a difficult thing. There are places where we don't have information, but also there's not necessarily a management need. So as management needs arise, or as the importance of an issue arises, then we begin to look at putting into place a study, much like we've done in Cook Inlet over the last 3 years. Up to 2013 or 2012, there wasn't... considered a real driving need to spend money and resources on that, on developing our capabilities for coho salmon in Cook Inlet. But since then, we've devoted a lot of time and effort and made a lot of progress towards developing the baselines and doing the application to fisheries.
Madam Chair, just briefly, the driving need came from the Matsu Valley delegation and South Central folks. It didn't come from the department or other areas of the state. No.
That is...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. A few more minutes.
All right, well, I'm going to skip that one. So let me give you the implications of this study. Population structure was not visibly eroded in Prince William Sound chum salmon populations. However, introgression was measured. Introgression is the insertion of genes from the hatcheries into the wild populations. Into the gene pools, and that both distance from the hatchery and life history can affect that integration rate. I do want to point out, go through this very quickly, this Western Alaska Salmon Stock Identification Program, WASIP, which was a large program funded by the state of Alaska. It rose out of Area M issues and interception fisheries, which affect a large group of people in Western Alaska. The idea was that genetics might be able to help out with resolving this issue. Senator Ted Stevens said that he would provide his political support to fund a large-scale collaborative genetic stock identification study if all the stakeholders could get together on the necessary information, the study design, and the results, so that they were all working together, whether or not they agreed on what the answer was, they had to agree on what the methods were, and whether it was acceptable or not. And a large group of people and organizations did join, including Native associations, fishing associations, local municipalities. Stakeholders did get together, and successfully we got through this study. And while there's still a lot of interpretation on what the results mean, there's been no argument on the science and on the actual numbers, because everybody was involved and agreed to what came out. Just to give you a sense of scale, you know, it was all the blue are fishing districts. It goes from Chignik all the way north to Kotzebue Sound. If we put a red line along that, measure that, it's about 3,300 kilometers of coastline, which is equivalent to either the west or the east coast of the United States. So a large, large area. Involved large numbers of fish. 74,000 individual chum salmon may not seem like very much, but at the time that this started, the average lab did about 5 to 20,000 fish, and one of the largest labs did 30,000 fish per year. So we had to be able to do 75,000 fish, chum, and 82,000 sockeye in about a year and a half. So it required, fortunately there was funding for this and the will to get it done. You've seen the chum-based salmon baseline. But it answers questions like, what stocks are caught in my fishery? And so there's lots of information out there on what stocks are caught in a given fishery, or how many fish were caught. You know, I don't know what proportions, but like Dr. Guyon showed, it could change with the numbers. So how many fish were caught? Again, we were able to answer that across this wide area. And what fishery catches my stock? That's one of those age-old questions. Who's catching my fish? And we were able to do that. The important thing also is to know is not just sockeye, but we did the same thing for chum salmon across this whole area. And the last, the flagship, is the Port Molar test fishery, which occurs in season and provides information that's useful to managers, to fishermen, and to processors. We get calls from processors all the time during the season trying to figure out what the latest numbers are, or from fishermen themselves calling us from the boats. Hey, do you have the numbers yet? Everybody's on pins and needles. The test fishery occurs along these black triangles going out from Port Molar towards Cape Newenham. Those are the stations. Basically, we're looking at fish as they pass across that line, and with genetics, we're able to distinguish those into stocks. That information then goes out in this type of a flyer. This goes out. I don't expect you to really get too deep into this. Unless you're a fisherman, a processor, or a manager, this, you know, it's hard to get through all this, but this is the type of information that goes out. What's important for you to look at is that the date at the bottom of this is July 10th, which is when it was sent out, and that information came from a test fishery that occurred on 7th and 8th out in a remote area of Alaska. So we were able to turn this information around very quickly prior to these fish actually arriving in the districts. It answers questions like what stocks are coming through, which is that blue bar that I circled, or what, you know, are there still a lot of Quijack fish coming in? And this information gets picked up in the trades. So on the deck boss, you know, in July 5th, Bristol Bay was a bust. And then all of a sudden, Bristol Bay on the 12th, 7 days later, was a late rally. The Seafood News talked about this last year about how Port Molar provided information that confused sockeye buyers because they thought that the season was over, and then all of a sudden there were a bunch of fish there. And if you look at this plot, you can see the gray line, which isn't showing up, is the average from 2006 to 2014, but the red line is what actually happened in 2015. And without the Port Molar test fishery information, these fish would have arrived in the districts without the processors or fishermen being able to know that they were coming. So the utility, it provides real-time information, and it provides a resource management industry tool. So,
very good. Thank you. Senator Welikowski.
Is all that information you had in the charts, what stocks are caught in my fishery, what fishery catches my stock, et cetera, is that all online somewhere?
Through the chair, Senator Welikowski. Yes, I meant to say that is a flyer that goes out. It's a news release. It's accessible to the public, and it's built on week after week, so a new flyer comes out, every four days or so.
Where is that online?
That is on the Fish and Game website.
Commercial
fishing.
Very good. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I was wondering if you could help me a little bit. You're identifying the red crab and Seymour Canal as genetically different from Stevens Passage and other areas, but where else in Southeast did you sample other than Stevens Passage and then Seymour? And for those that don't quite know where Seymour Canal is, it's just down the end of Admiralty Island, and it's like a big bay, is the way to think of it. It's not very far from here.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. I don't have the full list on me. I can look it up and get it to you. I do know that we looked at Barlow Cove, Seymour Canal. Now I'm blanking. It was mostly in northern southeast Alaska, though.
And if I could mention,
one more follow up, please.
Did you go south of in the southern southeast or down in the area like that? And then, if you could get back maybe to the chairman, or so I can get that information from you, or get a hold of my office.
Madam Chair, yes, I can provide that information and the papers that go with it to help, and then I'll be willing to take questions from you and help you understand.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Guyon and Mr. Templin, for the presentation. Very informative. Thank you. So next up, I've asked Bob Loeffler from the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage to join us and present a report that he and Steve Colt recently completed on the fiscal impacts of commercial fishing, mining, and tourism in Alaska. So this is to put in context some of the fiscal challenges that we face. I think it might be helpful to inform us in some of the decisions that we'll be making. So, Mr. Loeffler, thank you so much for coming to Juneau today and helping us with this information. And don't worry about the time. This committee is used to going over.
Okay. Well, I will still try to be quick. Thank you for the opportunity. As you said, I'm a half-time visiting professor at the Institute of Social and Economic Research. This is a report that was done in a small way by the Department of Commerce about 10 years ago. And so this is an update, if you will. It was partially funded. And when it was done by the Department of Commerce, it was called the Net Benefit Study. And I want to emphasize that we're really not talking about the net benefits to the state. We're talking about something much smaller, the fiscal benefits. What does the state spend? What does the state get in revenues? We're not talking about all the other benefits. Using commercial fishing as an example, there are lots of benefits for jobs, income, local businesses, community health. I'm talking really about the fiscal impact. And so let me begin quickly with some acknowledgments. My co-author, Steve Colt, funding in part from the Department of Commerce. Also, my position at ICER is funded by a grant. The Council of Alaska Producers, Council of Large Mine, gave a grant to the University of Alaska Foundation, which was confused enough to hire me, and so I work in part from them for under that. But our conclusions are Steve and my own. So let me begin a little with a little economist speak, if you will, but I'm talking again about fiscal benefits, which is solely revenue to the state versus expenditures to manage or promote an industry. Does not include those broader things that we all care about, jobs, income, local businesses. So let me just start right off. I'll do commercial fishing, mining, and tourism. So in your chart, you have a graph with three separate bars. I'm going to do one at a time on the screen. And you'll see the commercial fishing gives about $50 million to local communities. That's not comprehensive. And the green is what the state receives, which is roughly about $70 million. Now, I just look at state expenditures, the operating expenditures of about 80, and net capital expenditures. So if you look at overall, the commercial fishing industry gives a lot of more money than the state expends, and a lot of money to local, about the same amount, if you will, as revenue sharing to the local communities. It's an important foundation of local community fiscal stability. But if you look at the state as a whole, which is the graph, the set of bars on the left, the state spends roughly about $8 million less than we spend in operating budget. And if you include the capital budget, it's about $27 million less. Now, just for some caveats, we took the FY14 operating budget. We took about the average of 5 years of revenue, because revenue goes up and down, and the average of 3 years of capital budgets. So frankly, this is the overall conclusion, and let me break it down a little bit. There are lots of details, which I will please you by not going into.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stoltz.
Yeah, I'll keep this brief. Mr. Leffler, thanks. I listened to your presentation at RDC as well, and I appreciated that. We kind of flashed by the state contribution from the industry at 60-odd million. Maybe we can delve in a little bit. How much is available in unrestricted general fund revenue that's available for roads, schools, that's not already obligated in the budget?
Well, I think the way it works is this. The 53% of that $70 million that we get from the commercial fishing industry is what I would call true taxes, which are what the legislature can use for any purpose whatsoever. The next one over, the fees used for agency management, is what the legislature dedicates back to that agency for fees. And the last third is what I would call pass-through taxes. It's where the commercial fishing industry decides on its own to levy a fee on the industry for a specific purpose. Like in Prince William Sound, they might support a hatchery, or in Prince William Sound, they might support a marketing effort. And then the legislature collects that money and allocates it back to that purpose, usually to the hatchery or the marketing group, often through the capital budget, sometimes through the operating budget.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Stoltz.
Yeah, I was looking through the revenue source book, and it has a lot more editorial and less facts than usual, but I got through all of that, and it shows the fisheries business and the fisheries resource landing. Well, those are the two major. Everything else is de minimis. Two fiscal years ago, it was 26.4. Last year, it was 24.8. It shows 22.8. So a little bit south of $23 million. Is that the?
In 2014, the average of 5 years, the state received about $28 million from those two taxes, and passed an equivalent amount, which I will go through, to local governments. Is that your
amount?
But mind you, there's also the motor fuel tax, corporate income tax. There are 15 separate taxes that the industry pays in that in that three-part chart.
Senator Stoltz?
I just wanted to make sure I wasn't reading the wrong number, that there was $60 million bucks going in for roads and schools and so forth. That's what people think about when they think about revenues.
From the 5 years, if you will, this was all these are pass-through, but other than the pass-through, you take about two-thirds of that $70
million. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So this is where it comes from. And the next question is, with respect to the fishing industry, where does the $78 million, where do we spend it in the operating budget? About two-thirds of it from fish and game, a portion of it for marketing, which is in the Department of Commerce, and then some, about 10%, if you will, 9% for enforcement from Department of Public Safety. So we've got the operating budget, the revenue, and now the capital budget. We took 3 years of capital budget, and we took the projects, most of the projects from that, and we sort of divided those that work for fishing, and they took 51 projects were commercial fishing related. We allocated the portion of those projects that were due to commercial fisheries. So if we funded a hatchery, and 80% of the cost of that hatchery, of the fish were caught by Comfish, we took 80% of that capital appropriation allocated to that. You get about $20 million a year, if you will, that we spend through the capital budget on commercial fishing. The last, and I feel like I'm going really quickly because I'm going really quickly. So,
Dr. Leffler, one moment. Senator Machiki had a question.
So how did you account for the costs of things that are in the commercial? And I don't, frankly,
I'm sorry. Thank you. I
studies of limited value to me, but I appreciate you putting it together. It's something we need to understand. A lot of other data points that were left out of the study, of course, but how did you cover essentially all of the enumeration in the state is falls into the commercial category? However, it provides the data that the department uses for sport fishing opportunities. Did you account for that in the study?
In part, what I did is I actually work. So, for example, the commercial fisheries division also looks at, it also manages subsistence. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I just asked them how much of the general fund goes to subsistence, and I subtracted that from the general fund amount. So I did not include, there is probably some amount of data that's used elsewhere, and I didn't subtract that. But in general, what we did is we looked at the general fund revenues only. We didn't look at the federal funds or special funds and general fund expenditures. And if there was something special that was unrelated to commercial fishery, for the most part, we tried to divide it off. So that, for example, it's about, we took about two-thirds of the total budget of the, and allocated it towards commercial fishing. There's a lot more detail on specifically what we did in this, and I'm happy to get into it. But for the most part, we tried to allocate, we didn't try to count things that didn't go toward commercial fishing industry. With respect specifically towards data analysis, like the genetics, which is useful for a variety of things, we probably overestimated.
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Senator Machicki.
Just to clarify my statement, I believe that every industry should pay its own way and should be a net benefit to the state, right? That's just generally how I feel. We just want to make sure that we understand the full benefits and calculate how those industries should be taxed in a way that helps them pay their own way. But
I'm really trying not to have any recommendation on how industries, whether they're taxed too much or not, and I know that I did not include a lot of the benefits of the commercial fishing industry, which go to local governments, which go to people and businesses, and they're very specifically not accounted for. So I don't.
Sure.
Well, I want to make that very clear.
Wasn't in scope. Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. As you go through, I don't know if you have this data or not, but I think something that would might be helpful is if you have the revenue that each one of these generates, the or the profits that each one generates, commercial fishing, mining, and tourism.
Elsewhere in the study, I have the total X vessel value. I don't have the profit, if you will. That's proprietary. But I have.
Is that? Could you get that to us?
Yeah, it's in here. I can show you where it is.
You know what the revenue is for commercial fishing and mining, for example?
The X vessel value? I can look it up. I don't have it on.
You know what? We've got like 12 minutes probably. Okay. Maybe send it to the chair. And
But I'll quickly, some caveats. Conclusions for one portion of the industry, for the Upper Yukon, are not necessarily true for Bristol Bay, and that revenues, if you will, change dramatically with the run strength and with prices. And also, this graph here just shows you how the X vessel value changes, and as a lot of our taxes are a percentage of that, our revenues will change, which is why we took a five-year average. Finally, we don't manage commercial fishing like we do oil to maximize revenue. We would never let this happen with oil. But we do let it happen with fisheries, and we do that for a purpose. That is, our purpose for managing fisheries is not to generate revenue for the state. It's for a lot of other things as well. And this is really, I think, what Senator Machicki was getting to in part, that we don't, I'm taking a very small slice. So this is the conclusions of just the fiscal impact of commercial fishing, which is that it's probably slightly less than the state operating cost, a little further less if you include the capital budget, which I assume will be smaller in the future. But it provides a lot of revenue to local governments. I'm happy to go on to mining. I'm happy to pause for like 8 seconds.
Well, I want to interject one thing. Dr. Leffler's full report is on the ICER website, so you can access it, and the public can access it anytime. So all the data is there.
And, Madam Chair, I really appreciate the PhD you just gave me.
Oh.
I don't have one. I have two master's degrees, you can bet.
That must add up to something. Senator Stedman, did you have a question? Did I see you raise your hand with a question?
No, but I'd just like to make a point on between the oil and the fish. One's finite and one's not.
Yes, that's right. Let's go on to another non-finite, if you will. Mining.
Seems pretty finite in the valley.
Let's talk about mining. And this, I have, it's really the same analysis, except mining. Mining brings in a little less than $100 million, but our cost to manage mining is, mining just costs a lot less to manage. So we spend, in FY14, about $10 million. So if, including that or the small capital budget that goes to mining, that mining brings in 6 to 8 times what we spend, and it adds another $22 million to local government. Now, mining, unlike fishing, and to some extent tourism, which is broadly spread throughout our state, most of the local government comes from our large mines, for which we have only 6. And so the local government portion goes to where the mines are. The Red Dog, Red Dog's the only taxpayer in the Northwest Arctic Borough, Greens Creek and Kensington, the two largest taxpayers in Juneau, and Fort Knox is the largest taxpayer except the pipeline in Fairbanks. And Isabella gives money to the, or provides money to the Denali Borough. With respect to revenue, about 40% comes from mining license tax, about a third from the corporate income tax, and about 20% from the 3 mines that are on state land, rents and royalties. With respect to cost, now this pie is the same as the other agencies, but it's a much smaller pie. It's just the same size on my slide. Most of that comes through the Department of Natural Resources, some from revenue for collecting taxes, and actually a significant amount from the Department of Law, because it turns out everybody sues mines. The only other thing I was going to mention is that mining has an interesting arrangement where the large mines, where the state bills back to the large mines the cost of permitting and some costs for compliance and enforcement. So those are billed through DNR, but they're actually, the costs are actually to commerce and fish and game. So the DNR is slightly larger than it would otherwise be, and to some extent law.
Senator Michicki, a question?
I know it's probably not in scope, but how do you value the cost between a renewable fish, timber, tourism, really, right? I know tourism's not renewable versus a severed resource like...
I think you're talking about social costs and social benefits or values people place on them, and I really don't want to do that. I'm really looking at the fiscal impact of the state.
So, Madam Chair, just...
I don't mean to... value the question.
No, that's okay. So specifically, you're talking about general fund impacts, yes. Essentially,
yes.
From, okay, those three. Thank you.
And permanent fund. Capital budget, that says, it should say 2 projects spread over 3 years, but really there have only been 2 projects, the Hamar Mining District Road and a minerals assessment over that time period. And again, local government. Those are the 4 local governments that get a significant amount of money from mining because it's the 4 places where our large mines exist within a local government. So similar caveats, that is a placer mine isn't the same as a coal mine, isn't the same as a hard rock mine, and every hard rock mine is different. They're not really generalizable. Our revenues, like fish revenues, depend on prices. So 10 years ago, when prices were at $250 an ounce per gold, we got a lot less revenue. We've gotten a lot more as we've increased the number of mines and as prices of zinc and gold prices have gone up. Finally, there's some revenues that we haven't included in the study. The Alaska Railroad gets $20 million in, roughly, from Usabelli Coal Mine as they ship coal down to Seward. That's not included because really for 2 reasons. First, I don't know the the cost, that's a revenue, but unless you include the cost, and I don't know what the net is, and it's proprietary, but more importantly, it doesn't go to the legislature. The Alaska Railroad is separate. It doesn't get general fund appropriations for operating and doesn't return operating monies to the state. So because it was not really a state fiscal impact in that sense, but it's still important to the state. ADA is similar. Red Dog pays $12 million in 2013 for use of the Red Dog Road owned by ADA. ADA had bonds to build that road. The bonds cost less than the $12 million, but ADA keeps that money, and I know there's some that's returned to the legislature from all sorts of projects, but we didn't track it back. So there are important state benefits that are fiscal but are not included in this study. So that's really the overall conclusions for mining, that the revenue is significantly greater than the cost, and that there are enough concentrated municipalities that fiscally depend upon the mining industry.
Any questions on that section? Seeing none.
Tourism. Tourism is actually harder. Tourism is a pain in the butt. For example, we manage the commercial, and I don't mean that in general, that came out wrong, but we manage the sport fishery for tourists, but we also manage the sport fishery for me and you and your constituents. A capital appropriation given to the Anchorage Museum helps that 50% of their visitation, which comes from tourists, but it also helps it when I bring my kids there. So there's an overlap that is difficult to assess. So the tourism conclusions are somewhat less precise than they are for the other industries. I believe that it's dependent on economic assumptions. I think we made good ones. And I think other assumptions would be defendable but would end up with similar results. Tourism brings about $80 million to local communities. There's a variety of communities, again, that depend on tourism dollars. If you just, and again, that's that striped area. If you just look at the state, tourism brings in roughly about $20 million more than the operating budget. And if you add the capital budget from 2012, the average capital budget, 2012 to 13, it's that middle column, which is within, the difference there is within the accuracy of my report. So I would say that roughly tourism breaks even, if you will, up to the point where, for the including the capital budget, but provides a lot of money for our local communities. Again, the revenue, about half of that, a little less than half, was from the cruise ship taxes instituted in 2006, about a third of it from non-resident fishing and hunting licenses, 10% from for rental vehicles from tourists, 9% from corporate income tax. The majority of the money comes from, actually, the portion that we allocated from the sport fish division in Fish and Game, and then tourism marketing and Department of Commerce. Now, I said that we have on economic assumptions, and just to give you a sense of them, about 20% of the state parks budget is outsiders. So we allocated 20% of their costs, their general fund costs. 43% of sport fishing angler days are done by tourists. So we add 43% of the cost, et cetera. For the capital budget, it was kind of interesting. There were, in the three-year period, we looked at the 110 projects which were in part tourism-related and allocated that portion of the project to tourism, and it comes out to be roughly $20 million a year. And yes, we read every one of those. Municipal revenues. Again, this is a breakdown of municipal revenues. If you notice that the $13 million is the commercial is one of the cruise ship taxes passed in 2006. Then we have local sales tax, local bed tax, and then the dockage and mooring and revenue is for the most part Juneau and Ketchikan's fees on cruise ships. So with that, same caveats, expenses it's a little difficult to estimate. Tourism requires economic assumptions. There's some overlap with what expenditures that they expend to benefit me. The averages for a bear hunt aren't the same as a cruise ship, it's the same as a fishing lodge. The costs the state spends for each are different. But there are also some revenues we didn't include. We didn't include the railroad, the $20 million we get, $1 million from out-of-state residents, for the same reason we didn't include it in mining. Doesn't come to the legislature, and we don't know what the cost is. The Marine Highway was actually a little confusing. Previous study, because the Marine Highway gets about $20 million in revenue from outsiders, but the Marine Highway loses enough money, if you will, in providing its useful services, that if we had less tourists and therefore we ran less ships, we might actually save money. So previous studies that included Marine Highway as a net cost, it just seemed too weird to Steve and I to go, we're getting $20 million and it's a net cost, so we just put it up there and you can do what you want.
Madam Chair?
Yes, understood.
I just wouldn't want the people of Alaska to think that the way to get out of this hole is to shut down the Marine Highway. And the more vessels we tie up, the shallower the hole is. I think we'll come up with a more sophisticated plan.
Yes.
Any implications that I sent in that direction, I apologize for. I certainly didn't mean it that way. I just wanted to... Okay. So these are our overall conclusions, if you will. Tourism brings in more than the state spends in operating money, but it gives roughly $80 million to the local communities throughout the state. Some very quick observations. The first is that the mining industry costs very little for the state to manage. It's actually much less than actually I expected, even though I've been director of Mining, Land, and Water for 7 years. Relative to the others, it's not a costly industry to manage. The second goes to, I believe, Senator Wierakowski's question, I think it was your question, on percent of first market value. This is a percent of the ex-vessel value of fishing, the mineral value of the minerals, and the value of tourism expenditures that the state gets in revenue. And what surprises me is that they're relatively equal across the board. Now, fishing, all of them go up and down. Fishing will go up and down with strength of the runs, and it probably goes down with 50 cents a barrel, or 50 cents a fish at Bristol Bay. Mining will probably be down, go up and down with mineral prices as well. But for the five-year average, these were relatively similar across the board.
Bob, could you explain what first market value?
First market value is it's the value before processing. So for fishing, it's the ex-vessel value. For mining, it's the value of the minerals before they've been smelted out of state. And for tourism, we use the value of tourism expenditures.
Thank you.
It's really the value of the resource that the state owns, although tourism's a little odd in that sense.
I'll just keep it brief. Do you have any data on how other states, how we compare to other states? It looks like it's roughly 3%, 3.5%. How we would compare to other states in terms of these numbers?
I don't know other states' fisheries or tourism. There was a Department of Revenue study that compared us to other states and countries with respect to taxes. We were sort of in the middle. But I can send that to you. It was done about 10 years ago.
Mm. Senator Acostolo.
Thank you. And I want to welcome my constituent who, for the price of a airline ticket to Juneau, just upgraded to a PhD, so yeah. Congratulations.
It was valuable for me, really.
And I want to thank you for all the data and the work that you did on this. I just wanted to mention that if we start to go into comparisons with other states, we would have to have a report that has the identical assumptions that you put into yours. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to put that out there.
And I did not do that. In fact, I don't know it. Two more caveats. One is something that I guess you're all pretty aware of, that any of these revenues pale with respect to oil. These are very valuable industries, all three of them, for maintaining the health of our communities, for our employment, for social objectives, for culture. But fiscally, they pale with respect to oil. And I certainly don't need to emphasize that with you, but I do with other audiences.
Madam Chair, on that point?
Yes, Senator Stoltz.
Yeah, thanks. I believe it or not, some of my best friends are commercial fishermen, and I hang around them a lot, and they've been kind of rubbing it in to say a king salmon is worth more than a barrel of oil. And it probably is at times on the market. I mean, what can you tell us what the benefit to the Alaska Treasury of the two? Can you, would you...
Well, this is a comparison of revenues from
on a barrel of oil versus a king, versus what the state gets out of that pricey king salmon. Let's say it's a 40-pounder.
No, I can't. Sorry.
But is it a close call on revenues, or would you say?
I don't know.
I'm just fishing a little bit here.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
How am I going to have a good retort for these guys the next time I see them tomorrow? Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, my last caveat is what I've been emphasizing all along, is to me these industries are valuable not just for their fiscal impact, but for their economic impact to people's well-being and communities. I'm happy to take questions and hang around, and I appreciate the time you've given.
Any questions for Mr. Loeffler? You know, I would just comment, Senator Stoltz, it costs the industry about $53 a barrel to extract the barrel of oil.
Nets.
So $53 to extract that barrel of oil, and they're being paid about $32 for it, I think, today. So I guess overall for them it's a net loss. So thank you, Mr. Loeffler. No other questions. Thanks for so much for coming to Juneau and presenting this today. So that concludes our meeting today. Our next hearing will be on Wednesday, February 3rd. We're going to take up House Bill 115, which deals with federal land transfers, and Senate Bill 137, the mining tax proposed by the administration. Just for a preview, we will not be meeting on Friday this week to allow the Senate Finance Subcommittee some additional time for meeting. So the committee will adjourn at this time. Let the record reflect it is 5:10 p.m.